listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
At times of great change and growth on the earth, people change. They explore and take risks they otherwise would not take. My guest today has written a fascinating book which follows two women on their spiritual journey of discovery, taking risks that they otherwise would not have taken, one from the year 2012 and the other from 165 BC. Listen today as we discover what they learned about themselves and about the relationship between men and women, the male and female energy, as well as the fascinating Mayan culture. I'm Eileen Dillon, your creator and host of Full Power Living, and I invite you to join either of our chats, one on the emotionalpro.com radio show page, the other on blogtalkradio.com/FPL for Full Power Living. And we also really welcome your calls. We have a toll-free number, 888-498-9570. That's 888-498-9570. And for those of you on Blog Talk, you can use the call-in number there, too. That will also work. Libby Outlaw is a somatic body worker, an artist, and a writer, and also an organic farmer. You can find out about their wonderful 61-acre farm at maplespringgardens.com. In her first novel, which is titled In Lakesh, Libby has created a multi-generational spiritual guide as part of the unfolding story of these two women, one from 165 BC and the other from 2012 AD. They both travel through the Yucatan in Mexico, guided by the legacies of their wise woman grandmothers. Libby lives and works with her husband on their organic fruit, vegetable, and flower farm in Cedar Grove, North Carolina. So, Libby Outlaw, welcome to Full Power Living.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Oh, great. Yes, it's wonderful to have you. I want to clarify the title, In Lakesh. That's a Mayan term that strikes me as being a lot like the Indian term namaste. Share with us what In Lakesh is about.
Yeah, In Lakesh has, you know, a couple of meanings, and obviously in ancient culture language, it is sometimes hard to actually translate. But the one that I use in my book is that In Lakesh means, and it's a greeting, it's what they say when they come to see somebody, they say In Lakesh. And it means, I am a mirror reflection of you as you are of me. And it really represents to them the fact that we are just reflections of each other, that when I look at you and see something in you, it's really something that is about me. Another translation of it is, I am the other you, which is also a wonderful way of saying we are greatly interconnected. You are not separate from me. We are one thing.
Ah, that's so wonderful. And yes, that's a really big, important message of our times, is that we're all connected. We have, in years past, thought that we could do something that doesn't affect anybody else, and now more and more we're knowing that it affects everybody. So the Maya are known for tracking the movements of the celestial sky and also for creating the Mayan calendar. And I note that there were two Mayan calendars, one the short form and the other the long form. So I think in discussing your story, it's important that we know the difference and the importance of those two.
Yeah, and as the Mayans sort of came together out of separate tribes and grew, they, you know, different tribes did different kinds of things. They took things from other cultures, and so there's a lot of different things. But the two that are kind of known the most is the short term, which is basically like our calendar, although it's not the same in terms of month to month. It's not like the Roman calendar, but it is in relationship to the seasons and the way things grow and how that all happens. And that's sort of how they were able to know when to plant their corn and that kind of thing. And then the long count calendar was much more interesting. And for many, many years, people didn't know, what is this calendar? Why were they marking such a long time period? And a lot of people did a lot of investigation and realized that what they were really counting was the precession of the sun. And as we know, because of the wobble of the earth, the sun precesses as it comes up on the horizon. And it continues to move slightly. I mean, it's moving because the Earth is moving, but it's also moving slightly because of that wobble. And the Mayans really could see that, you know. And so you can imagine how they had to be able to look at the horizon day after day, year after year, lifetime after lifetime to notice, because it's such a small thing. But what they were noticing, and if they really looked at it and then determined sort of where it was precessing to, what they realized was that the sun was going to come up and actually cross the galactic center, but also a place that was very spiritual to them, which was in the Milky Way, called the Serpent's Mouth. And this is where the Mayans believe they came down into Earth and where they went when they left. And on December 21st, 2012, the sun was going to pass right over that hole, which we know now is a big black hole. And so they felt like when the sun passed over that, that was a huge transition for them as a culture. And so they were tracking it, and that was the whole reason that they did the long count calendar.
Let me just float something here on that. I had never heard that exact story on it before, and about the serpent's mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Why the serpent's mouth? What does the serpent have to do with the whole part also?
Yeah, well, I think that if you think about the ancient sky a long time ago, what they saw is not what we saw, because they didn't have all of the pollution. And so they could see the Milky Way as an amazing picture. And what they saw was a serpent that comes up, and then you can see the mouth. And if you look, where I live, where it's rural and so I can see more, I can slightly see that possibility, but I think for them at that time, you could see it so clearly, it probably looked exactly like a serpent.
Oh, so it's the Milky Way. Oh, I'm so glad I asked, because I feel as if we're at home in the universe. And how does that fit in terms of your story? Did you find that you were at home in the universe as you went through this journey that the book is about?
Yeah, and I think that really a part of what's really important is that where we do, even though we live on the Earth, we live in the universe. And so that is a part that all of the rhythms and, ebbs and flows of that flow in and out of us. And so when you really are able to sort of, take your vision out of just the focus of the one moment thing that you're doing, you begin to see there's so much more going on. And so part of the book is really about the journey through life that is much more than the little thing, that detail that I'm doing at the moment. And I think that's how the Mayans lived.
Thank you. Your questions are really wonderful. Well, to kind of follow up on that, where we're taking a larger focus, in your book, you focus on the December 21st, 2012, in so-called end time, that where the Mayans stopped counting years. Did they just stop counting for the 5,125-year period, or were they really stopping forever?
Well, I think it's interesting because a lot of people say, is this the end? Do we continue on? And my belief is, no, it continues on. And I think that's probably what they would have said, the ancient ones would have said. The modern ones say different things, like it happens in most cultures, as we have a lot of difference of opinion. But I think it is just like anything, an ebb and a flow. And this happens to be the culmination of something. And so each of their rhythms that go that are called baktuns, and this is the 13 baktun, but that doesn't mean that it stops at that point. And I think that that's part of, I think, a message in my book is people were so like December 21st means the end of the world, the this, the that, the other. And a part of what my book says is it's really just another day. But if we really align ourselves to the day, not just with us, but all the way through to the universe, each day has an alignment as special and as incredible as this day. And so I think that, depending on what culture you're in, certain days mean certain things. And so I think that's part of it is, this is important to know, but it's also important so that maybe you can participate in that every day.
How you bring up an interesting question. Dakey and I have both been
doing some spiritual development work, which requests us to tune in every day. But how do you suggest people tune in every day?
I think there are a few things, just very specific things that you first need to do, which is that you need to take your focus and your way of perceiving out of the eye, out of the visual, because the visual creates a narrowing of what we can see. And really the seen world, this world of reality, is a very small part of what's really here. And of course, you know, physicists have begun to understand this. So part of it is to soften your eyes, you know. Don't look at what is in front of you. And the other is to know where center is in your body, because center is the place from which all things come. I mean, that's part of the Mayan culture. The cosmic center, which was the serpent's mouth, was huge to them. And every day they knew that center in themselves and in the sky. And so it's part of like knowing your center is a way of opening to something different than the things or the polarity of life.
Hmm. Wow, that's lovely. I like that. So let's touch back into the novel. It's a story about Mesa, this young woman who lived in 2012, and she ends up going on a pilgrimage to return certain items for her grandmother who has recently died.
Mm-hmm.
And you use this story as a vehicle for teaching spiritual ideas as well as addressing the relationship between men and women or the male-female energies as Mesa's adult and spiritual relationship with her childhood friend Silas develops.
Mm-hmm.
You learned a lot about this on your own travels. I'd like you to tell us the roots of this information from
mm-hmm.
you.
Well, in the late 80s and 90s, I did a number of spiritual pilgrimages to the Yucatan. I did it with another woman, and we did a lot of preparation before, doing ritual and ceremony to have a sense of, one, where we needed to go, what we needed to do, what was it that our purpose was. A lot of it was a feeling like the earth was changing, and that the earth was asking us to participate in that change. And so the Yucatan was one of the places, we went to many other places too, but that was one of the places we went. And when we were there, a lot of what would happen for me would be that kind of the reality of the day would dissolve into feeling like I was there in, you know, BC sometime, and that I would begin to hear stories. I would sit on a rock, and the rock would tell me the stories of what had happened there and what this was about. And, you know, I tend to not do a lot of reading about history because I feel like then that colors the way in which I see things. And so I would go with a real open mind. And so many things came very clear to me, both about what the earth was needing from me, but also just about my own spiritual direction, the things that were I am here on the planet to do and be a part of. And as those things crystallized, I also went through initiation like Mesa did in the book, which was really initiation into the ways in which I am here to serve life and the planet. And so it was quite incredible. And so, you know, after that had happened, you know, that comes and goes and you go about your work and, you know, at some point you want some record of it. You know? And so that's when I decided to write the book.
Wow, that sounds really fascinating. And so also in Lakesh, you tell the story of Daughter, who is another woman who goes on a pilgrimage, but she's living in 165 BC, which is actually the beginning point, the beginning of the time this phase of the Mayan calendar that ends in December of 2012. And she goes over roughly the same things, and it seems to me part of your message in the book is to have an awareness of all the people who have walked the way we walk before. Is that
yes.
so?
Yes, so much. And I think that in many respects it's also that place of how many footsteps have walked that, but also that we are all the same, we are all resonating at that same place. And so a lot of what daughter experiences, Mesa experiences in her own time period. And so in many respects, it is sort of the repetitiveness. But I mean that from kind of an archetypal way of that, you know, there are ways in which we are all here as, you know, cells in an organism, and those cells do the same things. And so we aren't all, you know, we are unique in where we are in time and space, but if you take out time or you take out space, we become more the same. And so to me, the sort of showing those tracks as being similar, you know, both on the earth but also in the process is really important.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the terms you use in Lakesh is the great turning.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that to be like the turning of a cycle or a change point. And you also point out that at those change points, things are very different and people behave differently. And so daughter is in 165 BC. She's in a great turning herself. And that's also the time that the 5,125-year cycle that Mesa experiences is getting started. Do I understand that correctly?
Actually what it is that when a daughter goes and leaves her tribe and join and builds a new tribe, it's a time in Mayan history when the different Mayan tribes were shifting and changing, in large part because the constellations in the sky were really shifting and changing. And since they were all based on, okay, I know the Big Dipper goes from here to there every night, well, it started shifting and changing. And at that time, that was what made them feel safe was, okay, I know that the Dipper's great Big Dipper's going to do this. And as that changed, then tribes changed. And they began to, like for her tribe, they began to look at Capella as being the stable star because it was one that was stable compared to the Dipper. And so part of what happened at that time was that the Mayan culture kind of split up and kind of rearranged. And when it came together further south, which is where daughter went, that's when the people that came together realized about the precession of the sun. So they started counting that. But it was not, you know, it wasn't, as long from 165 BC to 2012. It wasn't quite as long as the 5,000. And so they started counting it then, even though it wasn't at the beginning.
I get it. Me and my math, huh? Of course, about 1,000 years missing there.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So Mesa, it turns out, was raised by her mother, who is portrayed as a really uptight, fundamentalist Christian woman who never talked about Mesa's father and seemed to indicate that he had died in an accident. And then she had this grandmother who was kind of a free spirit and kind of spiritually and ceremonially inclined. And it put these two opposite traditions inside of Mesa, who, as part of the story, have to figure out which philosophy she's going to embrace and then allow herself to move into that new self. And as I read that, I was thinking you were talking about forces that are clashing in the world today. In our political system, for example, we can really see the conservative and the liberal clashing with one another. Is your story to elucidate something about those forces coming together right now?
Yeah, it was definitely symbolic of polarity, basically. And the reality is the world is based in polarity. That's how it's formed. If we didn't have polarity, if we didn't have light and dark, we wouldn't have either. And so I think that polarity is necessary. But I think part of what I see as the great turning or the transition that's happening is that instead of polarity being a push-pull between each other, constantly this or that, that what we're beginning to do is grow in consciousness so that we can see things in a circular pattern as opposed to in a polar pattern. And so it's really this and that, not this or that. And so that's part of what I think Mesa was trying to figure out, because she didn't want to say no mother, yes grandmother, or the opposite. She wanted to say we. And so I think that in many ways in her journey, she explored, how can I do that? You know, and I think that's what many of us are exploring right now.
Wow. And that has relevance for the male-female issues you raise also, which we're going to delve into after we take this break.
Great.
You're listening to Full Power Living. My guest today is author Libby Outlaw, who has a first novel in Lakesh that we're discussing. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
As a parent, have you found all the parenting information you've been hearing lately a bit confusing? Are you having trouble sorting out the best response to your defiant child, or feeling hopeless about regaining respect from your teen, or determining whether your actions as a parent are the right ones? Instead of the usual pressures of parenting that you've been experiencing, you can partner with your child, raising incredible kids who are destined to become amazing adults. I'm Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, giving you the opportunity to become the incredible parent for incredible kids. We have the method and the tools. You bring your optimism for learning and the kids. Raise Incredible Kids offers a comprehensive system for raising kids who are responsible, make their own great decisions, and become immune to peer pressure. To get you ready for this new era in parenting, get my free 10-page report, Incredible Communication That Helps You Create Incredible Kids, by visiting RaiseIncredibleKids.com now. That's RaiseIncredibleKids.com.
Welcome back to Full Power Living. I want to thank you for helping us with our mission of transforming our world through the mastery and power of human emotions. As I'm watching the numbers of our listeners worldwide grow and grow, I'm affirmed in my belief that people want to know the real stuff they need to know in order to grow and evolve. And I love this doing this show myself because I learned so much, and I'm glad you're on the journey with us. So I have two announcements I want to make. Remember that our upcoming guests are listed at the top of our radio show page on emotionalpro.com. And next week I'm talking with another author, Steve Leibowitz, who was inspired to write a trilogy following his visit to the Holy Lands. The first volume, which we'll be discussing, is called Devorah, and it's the story of the first female judge over the Jews. If you do miss any of our live broadcasts, be sure to listen to the archives on Blog Talk Radio or EmotionalPro.com, and you can also subscribe to Full Power Living on iTunes. I also misstated our toll-free call-in number a short while ago. It is 888-498-0570. Is that right? Let me double-check on that. 498-0570, yes. One more thing regarding the conscious awakening of humans everywhere. If you are in Northern California or the San Francisco Bay Area, I want to tell you about an unprecedented opportunity that's coming to develop your own abilities for consulting your higher self and connecting with universal intelligence. We've had on this show recently Daniel Rechnitzer, who's the author of The All-Knowing Diary, and his wife, Sonia, who's the author of Pain-Free Childbirth. And they're going to be in the Bay Area starting August 10 to do a series of workshops and mentoring sessions. Now, Daniel was on March 14th and Sonia on June 20th, so if you want to listen to their ideas, be sure to listen to those on the archive. My friend Dakey Fox and I have been studying with them since June, and I find their work profound. I'm setting myself up to work with profound parenting, which will enable parents to go directly to the higher self of their child to help them in their growing up process and in solving problems. So if you're not in the Bay Area or Northern California, rest assured Sonia and Daniel are preparing to awaken consciousness in people all over the globe, so they're going to be going throughout the United States and into Europe. So you can find out what their schedule is by going to accessingui.com. That's for Universal Intelligence, accessingui.com. We're talking today with somatic body worker, artist, organic farmer, and author of In Lakesh, Libby Outlaw. Libby, consciousness seems to be a major focus of your book also. What do you hope that people will connect to about consciousness from your writing?
Well, I hope that in reading the book, there are kind of lots of levels and layers that you can pick. And I think one of them is that place that says, who am I? And that place that says, really, who am I? Not who am I in terms of who my parents told me to be and who my this told me to be and who that, but who am I? And that people are really going to move into that really self-awareness, but also that just noticing, being the witness of ourselves long enough so we know, and also being able to tap into the deeper part of ourselves. And part of what that means to me is not just meditation and all of that, which is also very important, but it's more that place that realizes that I am just a vehicle for a bigger organism, that I am just a small part of this big organism, which is the universe, which is life, which is those, you know, galaxies that we live in. And that if we can really tap into that, then we can really have a sense of the life stream that we're a part of. And so that we can be, you know, to me, consciousness is really about not just my individual consciousness, but universal consciousness. And so then we can tap into that so that we can really be a part of that. And so we aren't in that separate, isolated, you know, ego-driven or fear-driven place.
That's really interesting. Libby, I don't know if you're aware, I've been a psychotherapist for 41 years, and just yesterday I was speaking with someone about feeling very depressed. And my point to that individual was, if you can get yourself to thinking larger, if you can connect yourself with the universe or with all that is, there will be no room to be depressed. You know, so I really appreciate your making that comment.
Yeah, and I think and I think the way we do that, there are many, many ways. So I think in many respects, once we begin to create a structure and say, this is how you get there, then what ends up happening is we lose ourselves because we become the map and we aren't in the territory. And so I think it's really important in suggesting that to her, part of what I really like to see in what in my work is, can we find their map, find out what it is that they already know, as opposed to me telling them what I know. Because I know when I tell my clients, well, do this, you know, they'll do it, and, you know, sometimes it's successful, but they're not really empowered. You know, they really aren't, but when I ask them the questions that then they say, this is what I want to do, then you see the light come on, you see them expand, like you said, into the bigger space, and they really have a sense of, oh, this is my life, this is what I'm doing. And then again, like you said, depression or isolation or whatever those feelings are begin to transform into excitement and curiosity, and, you know, open those doors again that for a lot of people, I think they don't feel safe in those places, so they stay in that fear-based place of depression or disconnection.
And I think those wise words you've just shared, that's a big part of what I want to bring to the lives of children, to for them to find their own truth, which is why I'm focusing on this material. You know, Danky Fox, you stepped in when I was having some technical difficulties, and I realized that I've never fully introduced you. Danky has, over the years, been a wonderful cohort with this show, and she and I have done two other radio shows as well on conscious families. And Danky, you're a life coach. You're becoming a universal intelligence mentor. And I just want to welcome you to the show and thank you for stepping in when I had the technical difficulties, and also to ask you, do you have any more questions?
Well, thank you so much, Eileen. And I, too, so enjoy the context that you just set out, Libby. I feel as if, though I bumbled for many years through my life, it was always on purpose towards that larger goal of connecting with something bigger. And I do have a question in an overview sense. How was writing the book for you
a way that you stepped, I mean, it's obvious you stepped into a much larger context, told a much larger story with, you know, many lines of information weaving together. But what has it meant to you? How is your life more enriched? Because, and I just want to add one piece. You said in your recent statement, if we can connect. And I do come from a place that says we are connected. And you were connected as you wrote this work, as you've lived your life from what you say. What is it like to live connected that people can look forward to that steps out of that depression?
Well, I think that part, for me, when I was a child, I was very connected, and then there were a lot of forces that tried to disconnect me, and they somewhat succeeded, I will say. But for me, what really keeps me connected is the earth. When I really realized that I have a biological mother who bore me here and helped me out, but even more, I have the earth as my mother, and that she is really my true sort of integrated mother. And so once I was able to really connect to the earth, that changed who I was incredibly, because I realized that I was a part of this organism, that I wasn't just this separate thing. And that really kept me in that place of connecting. And from that connection, then I was connected to all the living things, all things that the earth nourished. And so that felt like a really big piece. In writing this, a lot of this was a way of reflecting back to me a journey that, you know, many journeys that I had taken in a way of seeing some of the levels. Because, you know, when you're in an experience, you're just having that full experience and you're in the moment. So that present moment is full in itself. And as you go to the next moment, that last moment is gone. And so you really stay in that present place with each moment. And so part of this was kind of a way of reaching back into that for myself and pulling it forward in a way that I could see, that I could really, in a sense, be the weaver of the threads. So it was really very delightful. I had to sort of get away from my real life to do it. So I would go to the beach and write for days at a time, and I would be in this altered state, both in kind of the shimmering of my past, but also in the shimmering of the energy that is Maya, that is the longer rhythms. And so it was really a delightful thing. And then, of course, it did kind of ripple out into my life and the way that I live my life, so that now, you know, even though I may be picking a flower, I am also really in that process of being there as if the flower is just being created and being born. And it is, you know, just in that place of also where it is finally, you know, done its job and dying. So I get to be in kind of the place where the timeline is limitless as opposed to, you know, one point on a line.
Wow, that's really great. Let's go further about nature. I think before the show I told you I grew up on my grandparents' farm in South Georgia, and that connection to nature has really been important to me. When I was a single parent and also helping 30 people a week in psychotherapy, my healing was to take myself and my dog to the wilderness for a week, just the two of us, because nature reconnected me. And I think a lot, you know, in our urban society right now, a lot of people are disconnected from nature. How important is nature to people based on your experience?
Well, I think if you are not connected or have a sense of the rhythms of nature, the thing is the rhythms of nature are happening whether you know it or not. And those rhythms have a big resonance, you know, huge resonance. And it's a resonance that has also got many layers because it's been doing it for eons. And so it's also a very long rhythm. And that resonance is out in the field all the time. And if we're not connected to it, then what we have to do is we have to create an armor between us and it. Because if we don't, we are going to be connected. And, you know, I think as your friend said that, you know, we are connected. But we can create an armor that allows us to not know that. And so I think that when we are in nature and we let ourselves settle into the rhythm of sunlight and sunset and, you know, different times of day and different weather and temperature and all the ways in which the earth is shifting and changing, that then we can begin to be really reconnected to what I call the bigger organism. And then also we realize that what we are and what we're doing is a part of a big process, and also that we are being supported by that process, that it's not something I have to push and pull. It's a stream, you know, a life stream that's happening, that we can really just get in the water and flow with the stream. And so I think it's crucial for people. And it doesn't mean that you have to be in a wild area per se, although it's much easier there, and, you know, there's just something about being in wilderness that is very different. But really just connecting. If we were each, everybody was to just stop at sunset and just really feel the energy of going from light to dark, I think it would change everybody. You know, something as simple as that.
Nikki, I hear a question in you. Am I correct?
Yes, I love that. I love what you're saying, Libby, because I feel that we are so much part of a larger process like this. And one of the things that I've been delving into and that we have been delving into, Eileen and I, is the idea of limiting beliefs, the beliefs that keep us smaller or keep us just reacting to the rain are different than the experience of the clouds are here now, but they will pass. And so there's ourselves as part of a larger stream of experience makes it possible to connect with our greatness, the greatness of the whole, as opposed to our learning about you're only this, you're only that, and all there is the rain right now. And I hear that so much in what you're saying here.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, it's also about, you know, where, what we're using in our brain. And I think if we work with our, you know, factual brain, or, you know, the neocortex part of our brain, which is always analyzing, discerning, and dividing, and, you know, deciding, and all of that, then we see the world in a certain way. If we go to our imaginative mind, and we use that to perceive, then all of a sudden, something that looked, you know, looks like a table, begins to be a tree that used to be the wood, that used to be the earth, that used to, you know, so that your imaginative mind really opens up a whole new way of really perceiving in the world. And exactly that. You get to be a part of the bigger process, the bigger world. And it's a very different experience than really the kind of factual world that, you know, a lot of us live in.
You know, that segues really well into the what you've done in your book in Lakesh, which is to follow the 9 principles of spirit. And you've got those listed in the back of the book. And things like self-reflection and impermanence and giving and receiving. Maybe we can talk about those more, but I wanted to just mention regarding self-reflection or the mirror. Mm-hmm. What you wrote was, this is Mesa talking, I saw an old image of my grandmother smiling back at me, only the mm-hmm. image was me. The mm-hmm. expression on my face was like the deep satisfaction I saw in hers when intuition told me to be careful. When I showed this satisfaction, she would say, you have the curse and blessing of the sight. I hope you can find the time to hone your skills, and I can teach you the ways of herbs and flower essences. And so all through the book, you're bringing in these 9 spiritual principles, and I thought that was a lovely way that you brought in mirroring of seeing ourselves in others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think the mirroring thing to me is really paramount. I mean, it is what In Lakesh means, it's part of it. But to me, it's a real solid step into a spiritual life. Because if we don't be able, if we aren't able to self-reflect, then most of the times what we do is project. And so all the things I don't like about myself, I might project onto somebody else. And so I'm not really taking any responsibility for them because that person is arrogant or that person is blah, blah, blah. And if I really self-reflect, I can really see that what I'm seeing in them is me. And then what I realize is I can choose what that is. So I could choose to see that person as being beautiful and opening and all of that. And I'm sure that person has that parts of them too. But the reality is by self-reflecting, then we begin to take responsibility for our life as opposed to letting other things be, you know, which is sort of that victim thing. And if we don't do that, then we realize we're the ones that are choosing our perception. And again, that builds consciousness. That builds a way to really begin to really create your life the way you want it to be, the way, you know, it is for you, as opposed to as just a reaction or just a projection of things that you're not willing to look at.
Oh, thank you. We are up to our second break. My guest today is the multi-talented author of In Lakesh, Libby Outlaw. She's also a somatic body worker, an artist, and an organic farmer, and she's bringing spiritual awareness to our human journey for all of us through her writing. You can find her at maplespringgardens.com. You're listening to Full Power Living. Stay with us.
You're listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
Do you know that emotionally, children form the foundation for their life during their first 7 years? Most adults just repeat that early emotional learning, good or bad, over and over for the rest of their lives. If you want to give your child an opportunity to live an emotionally masterful life, then join me, Eileen Dillon, also known as the Emotional Pro, for a free one-hour teleseminar on what it takes for your child to become an emotional master. You'll discover important things like what emotions are designed to do for us, four things it's vital for parents to tell their children about emotions, and the single most important thing to do when someone is feeling emotion. Register now at RaiseIncredibleKids.com. The time has come for us to allow emotions their rightful place in our lives as the tools and helpers they're created to be. Find out what you need to know in order to give this vital information to your children so they can live emotionally masterful lives. Go now to RaiseIncredibleKids.com for your free emotional mastery teleseminar.
We're on Full Power Living with author Libby Outlaw. We're talking about her first novel. I love the way she calls that her first novel, meaning we're going to get more from her, which is called In Lakesh. And Libby, I want you to tell our listeners where they can, all the places they can get a copy of your book.
Yes, you could get it at Amazon.com, which I guess for most people is probably the easiest. If you're a distributor, you can get it from Ingram or Baker & Taylor. And if you want more information about it, you can look on the website www.warwickassociates.com. And he was my publicist, and so he has an interview with me and lots of other information.
Mm. Okay, good. Thank you. I know people are going to want to get hold of the copy of this, and I'm deliberately not telling some of the stories so that because there are some interesting twists and turns. So the Maya, whom you reveal a lot about in Lakesh, changed their leadership from male to female based at different times, and they're guided by the birth of twins. If the twins are both girls, the women get the lead. If the twins are both boys, the men get the lead. And if one is male and one is female, there's a balance. I didn't quite understand how that combination occurs. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to know, was this a real Mayan tradition or something you created as a vehicle for the book?
I don't know. I mean, because it wasn't something that I thought up. It was something that I experienced when I was in Chichen Itza, and I experienced it in that time out of time place. And so I believe that we can tap into many things that happened in ancient cultures through really just sort of suspending the time place where we are now and seeing what arises. And so this was a story that came to me when I was actually at the Temple of Venus, and I began to see this unfold. And so to me, it was symbolic. It's like any kind of story or myth. Is it real? I don't know, you know, that kind of thing. But it is, it's very potent. In what's important to me about it is the fact that it is something bigger that's making that choice. It's not us saying, men dominating women, saying, okay, now we're in control, or women, you know, manipulating men and saying, now we're in control, or that. It's really something outside. And part of, in the book, what it's about is when the culture, when you're getting people who are lying, cheating, and stealing, and, you know, people are taking advantage of each other, then what would happen would be a foreigner would come, and she would be impregnated by a Mayan and end up having twins. And when that happened, the whole culture believed that that was naming who would be in control next. And that was all so that our, I'll say, limited minds or our needs were not overriding what the life stream wanted. And so it was really about something else, something beyond us is making that choice for us. And sometimes, yes, it's good to have men be rulers. Sometimes it's good to have women be rulers. Sometimes it's good to have both. And so I think that part of the reason for that is, that part in the book, is to just say, yeah, you know, sometimes we don't know what's the best. And sometimes we have to really count on, you know, whether it's a miracle, whether it's a sign, whether it's an omen, whatever it is, to let us know it's time for a change. And so that's part of why it's there in the book.
Ah, lovely. Well, you do a lot of exploration about male-female relationships as you follow Mesa and her friend and lover Silas through the book. And Silas has a lovely quote here that I'd like to read. As part of their dance of getting together. He says, "We have a chance to partner from a conscious, deliberate engagement, using all levels of wisdom and learning we acquire, using all the circles of message and myth. We have a chance to do it differently, as new and different as a 5,125-year cycle. It's all about the messages from the wise ones who speak of the change, that is growing, shifting the old ways out of dominance. I see this happening in the world as well as in me." That's a beautiful quote. I like that.
Yeah. Yeah, and I would hope that for all new and old partnerships.
Yeah. And so they, you know, one of the things that was delightful was, for example, in before we ever knew how Silas was motivated, Mesa was interested in being his lover.
Mm-hmm.
So that she, as a female, she was not holding herself back in any way, shape, or form. She was identifying what was important to her, what she wanted, and waiting for the opportunity to move toward what she wanted. That's what Esther Hicks, for example, talks about in The Incredible Power of Emotion, close to that anyway, where mm-hmm. she talks about how we human beings have come here to identify what we want and then on the stream of life to allow ourselves to move toward it. Mm-hmm. And I think you were allowing that a lot in your story as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. That's a really great way of saying that instead of emotions being what are in the way, they are the gateway, and they are what allows us to know ourselves, but also to guide us through that. And I think that that's what's so wonderful about full emotion, as long as it is not stifled or you know, shifted or changed, that it really is a gateway of opening. And, you know, I think that's part of what Mesa and daughter had to deal with was, okay, I don't have a script here. I don't have a map. So what is the map? And they realized that it was what was inside of them, what they knew, what they already knew through the sensations and emotions and thought patterns that they had.
Well, I know you've talked about this already, about your own unfoldment and kind of recapturing the deeper parts of yourself as you traveled, and the same thing happens with Mesa. And I wondered whether you're actually suggesting through the vehicle of your book that all of us have capacities inside of us that we just need to uncover and discover.
Yeah, oh, I'm still discovering plenty more, thank goodness, I must say. Oh, yes, and I think it is, again, just an incredible journey through all of life, and I don't think it really ends. You know, I think that it is a part of it, and each one is kind of the stepping stone to the next one. So I think that in that, we begin to see that, and if we were to stop, then I guess you'd call that death. But, you know, I think that it is a part of what we are all doing, and I think that when we get so bogged down in you know, sort of the details of life, it's much more difficult to know that. It's much more difficult to, you know, really see the signs, feel the feelings, understand what it is and what is my direction. And then also we have to be able to risk. We have to be willing to take that risk to say, I think I'm not going to do that job anymore, or I think I'm not going to be married to this person anymore, or whatever it is, to take the big risks. Because when we do that, that opens up more the capacity for us to be fully ourselves.
Yes, and in the story, Mesa, and daughter also, but Mesa pretty much took the big risk because of something that her grandmother had set up, including the financing for the process, and she knew that people like her mother were dependent on her doing her quest.
Mm-hmm.
However, the thing that was really lovely in reading the book was the time that she was able to take following her internal desires, her wishes, or following whatever opened up for her. Oh, this must be the next place to go.
Mm-hmm.
That really is an important point, that we, in our very busy culture, don't leave ourselves a lot of time to do that.
Right. We're always like one step behind as opposed to in step. And I think when we're in step, it's like I'm choosing each step. And that step is being chosen by the way in which I'm entering my life and doing my life. And if I'm not doing that, then I'm usually kind of either racing or sitting still waiting. You know? And again, I don't think those are bad things either. I think sometimes we need to be in that because that has an experience that stimulates and brings up other things. But I think when we're in that, you know, what I call the path of least resistance, or that place of the life stream, it's a very different experience, because one thing is you feel really supported. You feel like there is something that is moving with you, as opposed to something pushing against you or pushing you. And I think that there's just something very dynamic about when, you know, what people call in that intuitive sense, I know it's right. I know it's right, even though there may be, you know, other things saying it's not. And I think that's kind of the most delicious place in life.
And what strikes me is that those things that are just right and this is the next thing and so forth, those are going on all the time, whether we take the time to tune into them or not.
Right,
and,
exactly.
Yeah. So before we end, Dakey, do you have any other questions you want to ask Libby?
No, just my incredible appreciation for everything that you're saying, Libby. And I just love what you're asking, Eileen, as usual. So thank you.
Mutual admiration there. Right. Well, I do have one more question for you myself, Libby. A few years ago, I decided, oh, I'm going to write this in fictional form. And boy, I discovered how hard it is to write fiction. And so I'm interested in your process of writing fiction, because it seems to me like what I was drawn to see is that when I'm living my life, there are these things like we've been talking about that are happening over here, over there, some I know about, some I don't know about, but it's part of the fabric of my life, and periodically things get revealed to me. Well, that whole process is what you have to hold in your mind, in your brain, while you're working. So I was wondering, what did you learn about yourself when you went to write fiction?
Yeah, I think that what it really showed me was that I do know my life, you know, that I know it as a whole as opposed to the pieces of it. And so when it is, I'll say, in a cauldron, I can reach in and pick out whatever I want at any time and know it. It's kind of like the being able to tap into the Akashic Records or to know the history of something even though you've never read it. And I think that in doing that, then what I did was I pulled up kind of an archetype, or actually three archetypes in the mother, grandmother, and daughter, and, you know, really began to allow them to have a pathway or a thread through all the pieces of my life. And when I was able to do that, it drew different pieces together that were maybe I didn't see as connected when they happened. And so that was really, really, really interesting. I'm on my second book, and it's very different than the first one. The first book was, I've got these people, I got it. Well, this book is about four different people in four different places and their stories and how they come together. And so it's really very interesting because it's like I have to sit in four places as opposed to in Lakesh, I sat in one place, you know. And so it is interesting, and it's because it's also making me realize how many different parts of myself there are. So I'm learning a whole lot with this book as well.
What's the main thing you want people to take away from reading In Lakesh?
Probably that life is very synergistic, and that if you can find the synergy in your life, you will be in the life stream. And so find that, whatever that is, and let that be your guide.
Wow, that's lovely. Thank you for that. It's been fascinating to explore all the things that we've explored today, the Mayan civilization, male-female relationships, the stories of daughter and Mesa, etc. It's a lot that you pulled together in Lakesh. So I want to thank you, Libby, for appearing on Full Power Living today and for helping us to open our own minds for the great turning that we're all going through right now. So thank you for being here.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure. All right, join us live every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time and noon Eastern for more powerful experiences on Full Power Living. In the meantime, you can sign up to listen to our archives at emotionalpro.com. And remember, next week we're going to explore the experiences of Jews and Canaanites, through the writing of Steve Leibowitz, who is author of Devorah. This month we're enriching your life with differing cultural perspectives on life through the writings of our guests. I look forward to sharing this interview with you, and I want to remind you at this point. Oh, first of all, I want to say thank you to Paul Johnston, who's been our producer for many years. You've really held us together, Paul. Thank you very much. And we're now starting our 10th year of broadcasting. And I want to remind you to pay attention not to what you want to overcome, but to what you want to become. See you next week.
To Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.